welcome to episode 331 of Late Night Linux, recorded on the 21st of April, 2025. I'm Joe, and with me are Phelan.
331, it's a chvon.
Graham.
Hello.
And Will.
Hello.
Let's get straight on with our discoveries then. Will, Rocknix.
So, as you know, I spend about 70% of my disposable income at AliExpress. And recently I was going on a work trip and I wanted to take some handheld gaming with me, but I didn't want to spend a lot of money. And AliExpress proposed a small handheld computer system, game system, which is about $40, pounds or euros, all roughly the same, including shipping. And I had a quick look at the reviews of this thing, and it was all right. It was fine. It's about the size of an old-fashioned Game Boy, and it had two analog sticks and a decent screen. It looks okay. But I did a bit more Googling, and what was recommended to me was the Pow Kiddy X55. And on AliExpress, this was about 50 quid, I think, so not very much more. And on Pow Kiddy comes Rocknix, and Rocknix is the derivative of GelOS, which in turn depends on OpenELEC and all of those kinds of minimal distros. GelOS stands for Just Enough Linux, and it comes from those very minimal Linux distros. It includes enough Linux to get a screen up and get sound and Wi-Fi and Bluetooth and analog controls and all of that kind of thing. And it also includes RetroArch. And it also includes, on this advert that I bought from AliExpress, two SD cards, one with the OS on installed on it, pre-installed on it, Rocknix, and one with a whole bunch of pirated games already on there. Thousands and thousands of pirated games.
Does it say it's 2 exabytes in size as well?
It's a lot anyway. And it's games from 8-bit machines, early arcade machines, 16-bit machines, 32-bit machines, PlayStation 1, I think N64. I don't think GameCube's on there, but it might be. But just loads and loads of stuff. But Rocknix is a very nicely put together, minimal operating system and drivers for a whole bunch of like Rockchip cheapo SoC, ARM SoCs. And it works great. All of the Bluetooth stuff works. The Wi-Fi just works. The audio works. The power saving and suspend modes just work. The screen quality on the Pow Kiddy was really, really nice. The input leaves a little bit to be desired. Like, it's not the best digital or analog input on the device, but I'm nitpicking now because that's the device, not the OS. But the OS itself just works. It just boots up into a suspendable and resumable OS with drivers for everything you could need, and cores, which is what RetroArch calls the emulators, cores for pretty much every emulatable system you could desire. And so, yeah, if you're in the market for a really cheap, almost sort of disposable handheld gaming device, then I recommend the Pow Kiddy X55, and on it comes Rocknix out of the box. Really good. Highly recommend it. Get one.
You said it was like a Game Boy, but it's more like a Game Gear, because it's not the kind of tall, thin one. It's the kind of wide Steam Deck type layout.
Yeah, the Pow Kiddy is that form factor, like landscape mode. The slightly cheaper one that I was looking at was Game Boy form factor. But yeah, right. The Pow Kiddy is where it's at.
I really like the idea of this. I like the idea of something I can throw into a bag without having a case on it and worrying too much, which I worry a little bit too much about my Steam Deck. And also, my Steam Deck has probably just as many emulators and emulated games on it.
Well, it's funny. Just this week, I discovered or realized that one of the benefits of having a folding phone that has got a square internal screen is that it's great for emulators.
Cool. Definitely worth it.
Oh, definitely worth it, yeah. I haven't played much with it yet, but I played a bit of Mortal Kombat. Obviously, you have on-screen buttons, which is not the same as having actual tactile buttons, but if you've got a foldable phone, then that's just one more benefit.
How many Rocknix could you bought for the price of your phone? 500?
Yeah, 1,000. Fail him. Undercut F1.
Yeah, so I like the F1. I don't like paying for it, so therefore I watch the highlights on YouTube. But if I'm really keen, this guy has made an amazing TUI that you can run and you actually use a recorded file as well, but you can run and get all the data from the timing stuff. You can get a map of the track, where they are on the track. You can also get all the steward information coming through. It's quite amazing. It is written in C#, which is unfortunate, but there we go. But there is a compile binary for Linux, which works really well. And although it does say that it needs to use a couple of particular libraries for graphics in the terminal, it worked okay enough in KDE's terminal that it was no problem. So if you're into Formula One, it is one of about 575 odd types that are similar enough, but this one's quite good. I think there's a lot of people out there looking to fish for a job in an F1 team for stats and programming, and this is how they're doing it. But right. Yeah, it's pretty cool.
So you can watch the race live in the terminal effectively, because I'm looking at this screenshot of the map.
Yes.
And it's got all the drivers, and so it shows them going around the track in real time then.
Yeah, and believe it or not, there is about every, I think, something like 150 meters, there's a timing, essentially, it's not a Bluetooth energy device, but it's similar enough that it's...
A beacon,
yeah. So every about 100, 150 meters in an F1 track, there are devices. Actually, funnily enough, for this, the previous race, there was problems where interference and stuff, so who knows? There's probably somebody there, one of those flipper units, fucking up the whole F1 timing system. But yeah, so that information is available, and actually, they're really good for streaming all that data for people who are interested. And, you know, like, it's not like this is like some sort of guy sitting there trying to hack into something that they shouldn't be seeing. It's actually made available in raw data by the F1 governing body. And so, yeah, it's quite cool, and it's amazing. Honestly, the amount of projects out there trying to make use of this, I'm convinced it's people trying to fluff their CV.
It reminds me a bit of, do you remember Jeff Crammond's Formula One Grand Prix?
Ha, please. I had several incarnations of it, and the one on the BBC Micro. I think it was F3000 or F3 or something like that, yeah.
Jeff Crammond, a genius, that and Sentinel. But, there were mods, and I can't remember the name of it. You could run the thing that would extract all the stats from your racing and run it in parallel and extract all of this information and watch your races in real time in a text interface that looked just like this.
No way. That's sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see. Back those days, I never had a steering wheel, and I envied anybody who did, because you're playing it on keyboard, you might as well be playing Sid Meier's Railway Tycoon, because it was like it just went where you thought it should go, and you were like, nah, I don't feel like I'm driving here.
Yeah, but on an Amiga, I think it was like 5 FPS, so maybe the steering wheel wasn't right.
I see, my earliest memories of that sort of thing are, I suppose, Outrun, but apart from that, Lotus Esprit Turbo Challenge on the Amiga.
Oh, that was great.
Graham, Web TUI.
This is basically a CSS file for web development, I suppose, or for web styling, that simulates a text user interface on the command line. Now, I must admit, I've thought quite long and hard about whether this is a good thing. I think it's a good thing, but I really love the design of text-based interfaces. I find them distraction-free. I find them efficient. And on the command line, I just accept them. In a web interface, I also have to admit that I quite like them. And by importing this CSS file effectively, you get access to all the things you can, like with cursors, for example. I've tried it as a part of playing with kind of static site generation and theming on something that I'd like to do. It works really well. I wouldn't say stick to it 100%, but if you want it as a basis for creating boxes and fixed width pages with little distraction, I think it looks brilliant.
I don't know what it is, but it's something about the colors that they've picked for the fonts, the styling, the blocks of text. It's remarkably pretty how well they can do something with so many simple sort of features and that.
Is it me, or is it much easier to read and navigate and not be distracted by other things? Because I really have asked myself that question. And I think by and large it is. I like the aesthetic, if that's what Gen Alpha would say.
It's got a certain warmth to the pages. I don't know what it is. It's like the palette or whatever. But yeah, it's clear. It's spaced nicely, but it doesn't feel like you're being like, it's not like imbecile text either.
Gen Alpha would not say that it has a nice aesthetic. They would say it is aesthetic.
Yeah, It slaps.
Yeah, well, enough for them.
I've been spending quite a bit of time looking into static site generation, especially with documentation publishing for my own things. I'd like to like write more open source reviews for my own kind of keeping my hand in. So I've been looking at something that can manage this from just my own markdown files, basically. And I've been looking at AstroDocs. There's loads of these things, and they're also really complicated and a little bit obfuscated as they try to make money out of them. But AstroDocs is pretty good. It's very functional in a programmatic way, and it's quite open. And it is open source. And with WebTui, for example, you can just import your own CSS and theme it however you want to. And it works really well with that, even though there are fixed width styles already for AstroDocs. AstroDocs itself does a lot of other things. I mean, I think we've mentioned MKDocs and similar things in the past. And AstroDocs seems to be a much more modern version of that kind of approach, where you can create layouts, your own kind of JavaScript functions for building functionality into what are static pages of documentation, either in Markdown or HTML. Actually, if anybody's got any recommendations on something that isn't as complicated as AstroDocs, I'd really love to hear them.
Well, Hugo is the kind of name you know in static site generators.
Yeah, and I've played with Hugo. I wanted the potential to code stuff around the content that I'm creating. If I created easy metadata for things that I'm writing, for example, I wanted a way of kind of officially manipulating that data and presenting it in different ways or extracting it, so that if I put into a load of effort into writing stuff, I'd be able to kind of pull things out of that stuff and restructure it in different ways. And I couldn't find a way of doing that easily with Hugo.
Okay, this episode is sponsored by Tailscale. Go to tailscale.com/LNL. Tailscale is the easiest way to connect devices and services to each other, wherever they are. Everyone these days has a VPN as a sponsor, but Tailscale isn't like those. This isn't about hiding your browsing habits from coffee shop owners, and it's not about watching Netflix in another country. Tailscale is a proper VPN for connecting your devices securely. It's great for companies, and it's great for self-hosters. Loads of the Late Night Linux family hosts use Tailscale because it gives you the power of WireGuard with a simple and quick setup. I got it up and running in a few minutes without having to open any ports. Tailscale lets you connect anything, anywhere. Provide connectivity to any resource for your organization, from dashboards to a Synology NAS or Windows file server, from self-managed DNS servers to software as a service applications. If you want it off the public internet, Tailscale will provide secure access. Tailscale's personal plan will always be free, so support the show and try Tailscale out for free today. You'll get up to 100 devices and 3 users for free at tailscale.com/LNL with no credit card required. That's tailscale.com/LNL. On to a bit of admin then. First of all, thank you everyone who supports us with PayPal and Patreon. We really do appreciate that. If you want to join those people, you can go to latenightlinux.com/support. And remember that for various amounts on Patreon, you can get an advert-free RSS feed of either just this show or all the shows in the Late Night Linux family. And you even get some episodes early. And if you want to get in contact, you can email show@latenightlinux.com. Well, I've discovered Pinter because of their 3.0 release that came out relatively recently. Pinter is inspired by paint.net. And it kind of sits, in my mind, between MS Paint and GIMP. It's much more towards the MS Paint end of things, but it's just a very basic drawing and image manipulation program. You can open an image, crop it, add some text to it really easily. It does have layers, but it only seems to support exporting to JPEG. So there's no like project files or anything. So it's not for doing graphic design. It's for doing quick and dirty bits of graphical stuff. Like you just want to take a screenshot, add a little bit of text to it, export it, send it to someone. So if you kind of open GIMP and think, oh, this is too complicated, I can't be doing that, then I would say give Pinter a go. Now, related to this, I found myself searching for some fonts to see if it picked up on that with the snap of the Flatpak and everything. And I made an interesting discovery. If you go to google.com, so failing, you're just going to not be able to do this probably.
Yeah, it's not working. My pie hole seems to have kicked in.
Oh, yeah, weird. And search for, let's say, impact font. Look what happens.
I get an AI overview written in the font.
Oh.
Well, I get all the results are just in the font that you searched for.
I even spelt it wrong.
You're right.
Impact font.
I don't get any of this sort. I get just normal.
Okay, search for Comic Sans font then.
I've just done that.
Obviously, that's what you do. And I tried it with Times New Roman, and it just gives all the results in that.
Okay, that worked.
Yeah. It's a very silly thing, but I just found it quite amusing. Phelim, Python-SH.
Funnily, I've been listening to Popey go on about various projects he was converting from Bash scripts to Python scripts. It's probably about 2 to 3 months ago. I am that far behind in my podcasts in Linux Matters. But I had sent this to him, and I don't know where I've ever brought it up before, but Python.sh, it's a module that allows you to run command line applications as if they are a module. So if you want to do ls, you import the sh module and then do sh.ls, and essentially the executable, you just create it out of thin air what the executable name is, and it runs it as if it was a proper module. So ls, and then you get output from that stored as a variable of the ls of a directory that you pass into it. Obviously you can use whatever binary you want, and if it's in the path and properly found, or you tell it where it is, you can essentially get a nice straightforward Pythonistic way of getting executables to run, and it's very, very handy.
It's taken me a moment to get my head around it, but looking at the examples, I can see this is really cool if you're into scripting.
That is often the problem. It is so easy to write a script until something goes wrong, and then you have to think outside of Bash, whereas you wish you'd started off with Python. Well, this kind of gives you that simple way to call an executable. Like, it's like, oh, I need to run a thing that nobody else knows about, that it's called, you know, F1 Grand Prix data. So it's sh.f1 Grand Prix data, which happens to be in your executable path, and it will just pass back information to you. And there's loads of things you can do. Async IO to the thing, you can sort of make a version of it. They have this thing called bake, where you can essentially force options to a script where you might want to always to have a dash L for LS. You can bake that in, loads of things. And it's really well done, really nice the way the error handling works, because to be honest, if you're trying to do a shell script in Python to replicate the way Bash works and do it with the normal submodule stuff, or, you know, various other ones before that, like popen or whatever, it's just horrific. It's horrific. And you just go, okay, I'm doing a Bash script, I'll deal with all the shite that I want to do.
Graham, attention Kmart shoppers.
So, yeah, I was born in the 70s, but I consider myself an 80s kid. I grew up in the 80s. And I was lucky enough to go spend a year in college in the US, the very early 90s. And one of the things I liked to do was just hang out in shopping malls and just, like, watch people. I've had this kind of fascination, I suppose, with shopping malls and US department stores. Mildly, I don't know, there's a really great David Byrne Talking Heads movie called True Stories that kind of focuses on this culture. Anyway, attention Kmart shoppers. Kmart is a big store in the US, especially in the 80s, the 70s, 80s and 90s, and they used to play music, you know, like what Muzak you'd call, like elevator music. And somebody who worked at Kmart during this period archived all of the cassette tapes that they used to play in the stores.
Fuck's sake.
And have put them on archive.org as recordings. And I've been listening to them all week, you know, listen to the Christmas ones. And they include announcements starting with attention Kmart shoppers, right in between all of the Muzak and the Lionel Richie and all of that stuff. And I don't know, there's a weird, I get a weird feeling with it, with the nostalgic cassette sounds and the fact that this was played in Kmart during this time. And, you know, huge props to the person that's archived all this. I think it's a cultural phenomenon.
Is it versions of popular hits mostly then?
Yeah, there are some. There's a few hits interspersed with what must be library music, which kind of fits the vibe, and it's all very easy listening. You know, you get some very seasonal kind of library music, and what now would be generated by AI is, you know, performed on the cheap by some studio band, you know, 40 or 50 years ago playing Merry Christmas. There's a bit of both with some popular hits of the time. Non-contentious, very clean popular hits at the time. In between adverts for women's lingerie and cheap turkey and deodorant.
When I think about background music like this, I think more about the players than the music itself, because Tecmo, on a YouTube channel that I highly recommend, he has looked at loads of these background music players. Obviously, now it's all digital or whatever, but back in the day, it used to be machines that could run off reel-to-reel or cassette tapes or whatever, and they would have like endless loop stuff and whatnot. And that whole world is fascinating to me.
Yeah, I think this borrows on that feeling as well a little bit.
This marries up really nicely with a Reddit group called, I think, Liminal Spaces, which is just like very traditional Americana, like a picture of a vending machine lit by a single light bulb in a great big hallway. This is exactly the right sort of soundtrack for that. And it's just an amazing experience to think about the world at that time and the things that were going on. I love it. I really love it. It reminds me of a couple of things. One, there's another archive.org project called the Conet Archive, which is all like number stations recordings, which is similar kind of weirdness about them. Totally different subject, but a similar kind of vibe. And also a website called You Are Listening To, which allows you to mix a live feed from a police scanner and an ambient music track. And the two go together in a very special way. And it's a bit like watching, what was that David Lynch TV series?
Twin Peaks.
Twin Peaks, yeah. It just puts me in the same mindset as Twin Peaks. And I it's quite trippy and I like it.
Oh, these are great recommendations. We'll have to create a list for the podcast notes.
Yeah, I've been Googling shit and sticking it in the notes, so I'll link to all the things we mentioned. Right, well, we better get out of here then. We'll be back next week when who knows what it will be. But until then, I've been Joe.
I've been Phelan.
I've been Graham.
And I've been Will.
See you later.